Thank you, David, for organising this event and all the other events that the GBD organises. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to the SBA for hosting. So I was asked as I walked in what I'm going to be talking about, and I said, deliberately and correctly, I'm going to be talking about why people shouldn't come to shul on Yom Kippur. Why you shouldn't come to shul on Yom Kippur. And the reason I say that, and obviously there is a little catch, is it always amazes me and profoundly saddens me that the people who come to shul once a year choose Yom Kippur as the day to come. Of all the days in the year to choose, it is, in my opinion, the worst possible day. And that is for two reasons. And the first reason is because it's long, and if one doesn't know what's going on, it's exceptionally boring, and long again, and difficult, and long again. And if one's going to choose a day, there are many other days of the year, roughly 364 days, which are much more fun. And if one's going to choose one day a year, come, I don't know, some random Monday morning when it only takes half an hour and it's in and out and so on. But nevertheless, people choose that particular day to come. But the other reason on which I want to focus is more of a theological and philosophical reason. That Yom Kippur is the worst possible day to sample what Judaism and Jewish life is all about. It gives, and for a deliberate reason, the worst possible picture, because it is a day which is antithetical to the nature of Jewish life and our understanding of how Judaism is to be articulated in the world. And in order to explain what I mean, I want to move and look at what turns out to be a parallel topic, which is the role of the Mishkan, the temple, the tabernacle, and the structure of the book of Vayikra. And hopefully by the end we'll see how this links into Yom Kippur as well. The book of Vayikra, in Latin, Leviticus, is often assumed to be, if one asks a random sample of people who have some idea of the answer, what's Leviticus all about, people will say it's sacrifices. Temple things, and the name even suggests that. And if one looks at where it comes in the canon, it comes straight after the end of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, which ends with the construction of the Mishkan, and then we move into Leviticus, which has very few narrative sections, which is apparently all about the use of the Mishkan. But in fact, on closer example, it's not. Even though Romans called it Leviticus, even the rabbis called it Torat Kohanim, they called the book of Leviticus Torat Kohanim, the book, the law of the priests, we find that roughly the first two and a bit Sidrot are the laws of sacrifices. Vayikra and Tzav detail in quite intrinsic detail how sacrifices are to be brought, and they basically say that same whole thing twice. But then the mood changes. We get onto the laws of kosher and unkosher animals. We get into Chagim and how each Chag is to be observed. And then by the end of the book of Vayikra, we have the laws of Shemitah, we have the laws of Yovel, the sabbatical year, the Jubilee year, we have the laws of charity, we have the laws about how we must help each other and how we must make sure that nobody falls into poverty, and many, many other topics. So the book of Vayikra is not just about the Mishkan, the temple, sacrifices, ritual things. It's really about the whole panoply of Jewish life. And in particular, one can actually pinpoint the break. The break comes in the Sedra of Achrei Mot. And Achrei Mot, the first half of which, deals with the service of Yom Kippur. In the temple, the sacrifices that are brought, the detailed procedure that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, follows throughout the day, the various special rituals that he performs. And then, a little bit later, it's a very small gap, a little bit later we hit the Seder of Kedoshim, which means you shall be holy. We start with chapter 19 of Leviticus, sometimes called the Holiness Code. And how do we manifest Kedoshim to you? How do we manifest you shall be holy? With a whole list of mitzvot, which seem to be totally random, that cover every aspect of human life, culminating, if you like, in the Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha, in the middle of that chapter, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So what's going on here? Why is the book of Vayikra containing such disparate themes, particularly when, at first glance, one might assume it's all about the Mishkan, it's all about holiness, it's all about ritual? The answer to that, I think, goes to the heart of what is religion all about. How does one achieve sanctity in this world? Perhaps the ultimate question of a student or a follower of religion. How does one achieve sanctity in this world? And as explained by Rav Soloveitchik and others, there are, amongst classical religious approaches, two distinctly different answers to that question. The traditional answer, and that followed by many religious approaches, is that one achieves spirituality by distancing oneself from physicality. There is a dualism in the world. One is either immersed in physicality or one is immersed in spirituality. Now, of course, there's always elements of both because we represent one holistic individual. But according to this philosophy, in order to achieve spirituality, one has to divest oneself as much as possible of physicality. That was, for instance, very much the pattern of the early church, and it is still the pattern of some aspects of Christianity, and occasionally some aspects of Judaism as well, but it's, we'll see mainstream Judaism has a different view. What does it mean to divest oneself of physicality? It means one seeks spirituality, one seeks holiness in not eating, in being celibate, in cutting oneself off from society, in living in a monastery, living in a convent, living on the top of poles, living in a cave as the early hermits did, in their quest for the ultimate spirituality, their quest for kedusha, for holiness. Now, of course, there is a corollary to this, and it's not a good corollary. There is the idea that holiness is to be found in a limited fashion in certain places, like in the church, like in the temple, like for some in the synagogue. And if I want to be holy, I go to church or I go to shul and I do all sorts of holy things there. And when I come out of synagogue, when I come out of church, I am no longer seeking spirituality because I am returning to physicality. And that explains how you can find among so-called religious people the worst type of hypocrisy, that people are very religious in their church or shul or temple and apparently very irreligious outside. And because they would say, if they thought about it, there is no contradiction, there is no hypocrisy, because when I want to be holy, I'll go to the holy place and live a holy life, and when I come out of the holy place, I'll live a non-holy life, because by definition, if I'm out of the holy place, I'm not living a holy life. That, with its unfortunate corollary, is a common philosophy of religion. Judaism, perhaps uniquely, I'm not sure, has a different view. Judaism says that in order to achieve sanctity, we do not flee from the physical world, we sanctify the physical world. When God came to give the Torah to the Jewish people, as described in chapter 19 of Shemot of Exodus, there was a whole series of discussions between God and Moshe before the actual moment of the theophany of the revelation at Sinai. And God says to Moses, he says, come up the mountain, come up Mount Sinai, and I've got some instruction for you. And what the instruction is to stop the people coming up the mountain. Set up a boundary around the foot of the mountain. The people must know they mustn't cross it. And then if you look carefully in the text, God says, it's not enough that you've told the people once. You've got to go back and tell them again, because they might forget. And Moses says, what do you mean they might forget? I mean, I've told them once, isn't that enough? God says, no, you've got to go down and tell them not to come up. And this, there's sort of a motif emerging, and the motif is descend, don't ascend. And this actually culminates in the giving of the Torah itself. Not only do the people not come up, God himself comes down. God descends onto Mount Sinai. As Rashi puts it, he actually brought heaven with him and descended on the heavens, and he brought the heavens down to earth. Let me give you another example, which clearly is metaphorical. The Gemara Shabbos talks about how when Moses went up to receive the Torah from God, the angels complained to God, and the angels said, what's the point of giving it to some human being? They're going to muck it up. And God said to Moses, you answer them. And Moses, somewhat nervously, answered them and said, what's written in this Torah? And he goes through the Ten Commandments. And he says, what's the first commandment? I am God who brought you out of Egypt. And he says to the angels, did God bring you out of Egypt? And the angels say, no. And then he says, honor your parents. Do you have parents? And the angels say, no, we don't have parents. And then he says, it says there, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't murder. Are you ever tempted by the evil inclination to commit any of these acts? And the angels say, no, we're not. And the angels have to agree on the basis of Moses' argument, but the Torah does not belong in heaven, it belongs on earth. And what do we see? How do we achieve holiness? We achieve holiness, for instance, by the way we eat food. Now, eating food is a basic animalistic act. We eat food, animals eat food. How do we choose to eat food? By saying blessings before, by saying blessings after, by restricting our desires to kosher food only, and pushing away the desire to eat non-kosher food. By doing so, we convert a basic animalistic act into something which becomes holy. Celibacy has no place in Judaism. We are encouraged to have a family. We are encouraged to get married. We are encouraged to indulge in sexual relations. But, in appropriate way, appropriate time, an appropriate place, again, we don't cut ourselves off from physicality. We channel our desire from physicality according to how the halakha tells us to behave. And sitting here in the middle of the city, I will mention that some people feel that a boardroom is exempt from religious laws because it's not a place of holiness, it's not a place of spirituality. Well, one quarter of the Shulchan Aruch deals with business dealings, and that is the way that we sanctify our business dealings. Just as we sanctify our food, we can sanctify our ethical conduct in every sphere of human existence by following the halakha, by applying ourselves to how God wants us to live. So it is not the Jewish way to say that God is to be found in the temple. God is to be found in the kitchen. God is to be found in the bedroom. God is to be found in the boardroom. God is to be found in the marketplace. God is to be found wherever we choose to let him in. That is the Jewish approach to spirituality. Not to flee from the physical world, but to sanctify it. So what do we find in the temple? What do we find going back to the structure of the book of Leviticus, which, as I said, is presumed to be about the temple, sacrifices, ritual, that sort of stuff. And yet it's not. What we find is as follows. That when the Jewish people built the temple, which is consecrated, as I said, at the end of the book of Exodus, it became a receptacle for God's presence in the world. It became the place where the Shekhinah, God's presence, dwells. But, as the Jews were told when they were instructed to make the Mishkan in the first place, Asuli Mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham, make me a Mikdash and I will dwell amongst you, not just in it. Because the way it works is that God's presence, if you like, finds a home in the temple, in the sanctuary, and from that place it emanates outwards. So the temple is not just a receptacle, it is a channel for Kedusha, for holiness, to spread. Now, one can look at this in some sort of mystical, Kabbalistic way, but that's not my style, and I certainly don't understand anything like that. So I'm going to look at it from an ethical, educational point of view. The lessons that we learn in the temple, we then apply outside the temple. What do we learn in the temple? We learn to follow God's dictates. We learn to do things as he tells us to do, and not by creating some creative service and do it the way we feel it should be done. That was the lesson of Nadab and Abihu. They learned the hard way. And we learn the essence of Kedusha is to limit our desires, as Rav Hirsch says. That's where we find holiness. And we learn to do things in a particular way and not just the way we necessarily want to or even feel is the way that we should do. We take that message from the temple and we take it outside and we apply it to our daily lives. And that is why the book of Vayikra, Torat Kohanim, the law of the priests, is not just about priests. It's the book that tells us how to make ourselves into Mamlechet Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh, into a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And that is why, even though the Mishkan is the holiest place, the idea of holiness applies everywhere. And we learn throughout the rest of the book of Vayikra about holiness in time. That's why we go for the Chagim, we go for the festivals. Holiness in space. That's why the land of Israel is distinguished from other places in the world, and that's where Shemitah and Yovel, the sabbatical and jubilee years, apply. And we learn about holiness, as we say in Kedoshim Tehiyu in that chapter 19, which covers every possible aspect of human existence. The Mishkan was indeed the holiest place, but as I said, the holiness of it emanates outwards. The holiest man, if you like, was the Kohen Gadol. The holiest spot of the Mishkan of the temple was the Kodesh Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies. And he went into the Holy of Holies on the holiest day of Yom Kippur. And whereas the Mishkan represents this ideal of being the receptacle of God's presence, but then the channel by which it emanates in space, so Yom Kippur is the same idea as applied in time. Yom Kippur is a day which appears to be the ultimately holy day. And Yom Kippur appears to represent precisely the view of holiness of religion, which I rejected a few moments ago. Yom Kippur is a day when we try to be entirely non-physical. We give up on all our basic desires. It's not a day when we only eat kosher food. It's a day, as we all know, when we don't eat any food. And the various restrictions that we apply on Yom Kippur make us very much like those cave-dwelling hermits who cut themselves off from family life, who cut themselves off from the pleasures of the flesh, who cut themselves off from food, who spent the whole day in prayer and in contemplation. So on Yom Kippur, if you like, despite everything I've just said, we do try to achieve holiness through means of abstinence and cutting ourselves off. And you know what? We fail miserably. Now, maybe it's just me, but some people say that fasting Yom Kippur gives a tremendous sense of spiritual cleansing, gives a tremendous sense of holiness, and with fasting comes this elevated soul. I have to say, in all honesty, the only thing I get from fasting is intense hunger. I don't get any of that elevated soul stuff. And as the day goes on, I get more intense hunger. And I think the message of Yom Kippur is partly precisely to tell us what miserable failures we are when we attempt to cut ourselves off from the physical world. Now, to put it another way, that is why we do this for one day a year. And we do something completely different for 364 other days of the year. For one day a year, we live in the temple. But the rest of the time, we live outside of the temple. And what Yom Kippur should do is be the channel for Kedusha, for holiness, which comes on that day and then emanates out through the rest of the year. And therefore I go back to what I said at the beginning about people who come to Shul one day a year. Not only do they choose the day, which is a really long and difficult day, but they see a side of Judaism which is utterly atypical, utterly different from the rest and the totality of Jewish philosophy. Yom Kippur is the one day, one moment in time, when we achieve spirituality by avoiding physicality, and what we should learn from it is for the rest of the year, we achieve spirituality by embracing and sanctifying physicality. Now, how do we do this? How does Yom Kippur help us to do this? Now, again, I could say, or if I understood it in some sort of mystical way, that the Kedusha of Yom Kippur permeates throughout the year. But I would say, in an educational way, number one, we learn that we do try to limit our desires. Now, in Yom Kippur, we limit them in a 100% way. And the rest of the year, we learn to limit and hence channel and hence sanctify. But also, as we know, that the purpose of Yom Kippur, the focus of our activities on Yom Kippur is teshuvah, is repentance. And the purpose, the way we do repentance is we reflect on the past and we resolve for the future. What we should achieve on Yom Kippur is not just praying and being hungry and feeling good or bad about it. What we should achieve on Yom Kippur is a resolution for the future, that the decisions that we make on Yom Kippur, the reflection that we undergo on Yom Kippur, the evaluation that we do of ourselves, must impact on how we behave for the rest of the year. So Yom Kippur itself, this island in time, this moment which is so distinct, is the moment which guides our activities for the rest of the year. And a real effort on Yom Kippur will achieve our elevated level the rest of the year, but not in the Yom Kippur sense, not in the sense of fasting and restricting, but in the sense of sanctifying us, the role around us. I think the Jewish calendar contains a very clear message. The Jewish calendar, especially at this time of year, is a nightmare for schools. I'll just point out, because I can come to that we have a month to teach about Rosh Hashanah, we have a week to teach about Yom Kippur, and then if we're lucky, if we're not on holiday, we have a couple of days to teach about Sukkot. There must be some planner
in the fact that Yom Kippur comes only a few days before Sukkot. And I think there is. And I think the juxtaposition of Yom Kippur and Sukkot expresses this message that I'm sharing very clearly. When we leave Yom Kippur, we head straight for Sukkot. And Sukkot is really the antithesis of Yom Kippur. On Sukkot, we have this wonderful deal. This wonderful deal that we construct a little hut, or a big hut, or a beautiful hut, or an extension of our house, or whatever it might look like. But when we sit in this booth, in this sukkah, and when we do anything, we are doing a mitzvah. Sitting, reading a book, reading the paper, becomes a mitzvah if we do it in the sukkah. Eating. I keep talking about eating, I suppose we're Jews, it's sort of natural. Eating, well, which we do quite a lot on Sukkot, and we find all sorts of opportunities to do so, whether we eat with largesse or restrictiveness, becomes a mitzvah, becomes something holy. The message of Sukkot is, if you sanctify your life by living it according to halakha, then every aspect of your life, of your basic, physical, normal, ordinary life, can be sanctified. That's what we do as soon as we leave Yom Kippur. We go and build our sukkah, we look towards sukkah, and a few days later we're sitting in the sukkah, living a life so totally different to the one we lived on Yom Kippur, and yet, also achieving sanctity. Also seeking and reaching spirituality. So one day a year, spirituality by abstinence. Almost immediately after, a whole week of spirituality by the complete opposite. And then we leave that period altogether and we head for the rest of the year, understanding how we can get the balance right between the two. Let me just conclude by saying, the moment in the Sefer Vayikra, I said, when we move from one to the other, but from the mode of concentrating on the temple to concentrating on the message outside the temple, is when we learn about the laws of Yom Kippur. And I hope you can see now why that fits into place, because Yom Kippur is, if you like, the final moment when we take this message, we absorb this message, and then we apply it outside the temple, and indeed outside of Yom Kippur. That's why Yom Kippur is the springboard for the rest of the book of Vayikra, where we seek spirituality in the world around us. But one can even reduce this further to a sort of fractal pattern, where we can see this breakdown within the laws and within description of the Yom Kippur avodah, of Yom Kippur service itself. The pinnacle, and perhaps one of the strangest bits about the Yom Kippur service, is when the Kohen Gadol, amongst all the various sacrifices he has to perform, and the blood he has to sprinkle here, there, and everywhere, selects, or has selected for himself, two goats, on which he draws lots. And we're told the goats have to be equal, same size, same color, same weight, so as equal as possible. He draws lots, he picks out two ballot papers, as it were, and which ballot paper occurs, which comes up on which hand, and which one he places on the head of which goat, will determine the fate of those two goats. They come in absolutely equal, and yet their fates are very, very different. Although perhaps not so different, because they both end up dead. One is offered, as are many other sacrifices that day, on the altar in the temple. And then its blood is sprinkled in the Holy of Holies. The other has a very different fate. It's also sacrificed in a sense, but in a way which is different from every other sacrifice in the Torah, which, were it not specifically commanded on Yom Kippur, would never be done under any circumstances. It is sacrificed outside the temple. It is thrown off a cliff. It bears the sins of the Jewish people, however that's to be understood. It is translated and creates the idiom of the scapegoat. But what's very interesting, and what I think sums up what everything I've been trying to say, is those two goats, which start off exactly the same, go in opposite directions. One goes into the Bet Mikdash, into the Holy of Holies, and the other goes outside, into the world around. And that, if you like, is the pinnacle of the Yom Kippur Avodah, the Yom Kippur service, and that also is the pinnacle of this distinction between the first half or the first quarter of the book of Vayikra and the second three quarters. Holiness exists in the temple. And if you go further into the temple, if you go into the Holy of Holies, there you will find the holiest place, as the name suggests. And we do that on Yom Kippur. But the Yom Kippur service is not complete without going outside, without sending the goat out beyond the confines of the Bet Mikdash, out into the world out there, ultimately out into the wilderness there to meet its fate. The message of Yom Kippur is always going inwards and always going outwards. The message of Yom Kippur is that we resolve on Yom Kippur to change ourselves and our lives and our world on the successive days and months and years thereafter, and the spirituality that we seek in this most unique and exceptional way on Yom Kippur, spirituality through abstinence, we learn that message and then we apply it in completely the opposite way in the days and months and years thereafter that we seek spirituality by restraint, by controlling our desires, but by living our lives in accordance with halakha and sanctifying the physical world around us. I wish you all a gemar chatima tova, a good sealing and a good completion to this process. That was 10 past one. So, 5 minutes of questions? Or carry on eating in the spirit of